You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
What does it mean to have the USDA declare our city the epicenter of food hunger? How do habits and attitudes around food shift? And what's the balance between availability and economics? These are some of the questions our panelists will consider tonight, each sharing from their unique experience as activists for food justice. With the book To Live and Dine in LA, Menus and the Making of Our Modern City, as our prompt, author Josh Kuhn and our guest panelists will share with us how we got to this point, who is influencing this debate, and hopefully, where we can go from here. We're thrilled to have such a dynamic panel assembled, and I'd like to briefly share who they are. Neelam Sharma is a community activist and executive director of Community Services Unlimited, an organization that works to address inequalities and systemic barriers that make sustainable communities unavailable. Neelam's activism stems from her pre-teen years living back in London where she grew up, and then extended to her founding a Black Panther organization in Britain in the mid-1980s. Her passion for food justice is deep-seated, and we have her to thank for making LA the first city in the nation to ban soda machines in schools. Sitting next to Neelam is Ron Finley, widely known as the Gangsta Gardener, who's moving the horticultural revolution forward through his work to transform barren parkways into edible gardens. Ron travels widely to speak to the importance of growing your own food, and he reminds us that to change a community, you have to change the composition of the soil. And sitting next to Ron is Elizabeth Medrano, whose social and environmental justice work goes back to the mid-1990s. Elizabeth currently works as the coordinator and organizer for the Healthy School Food Coalition, a program of the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. Elizabeth focuses on organizing and training school populations on advocacy and implementation of school food and nutrition motions adopted by the Los Angeles Board of Education. That pause was to have the sirens pass by. We might be getting a few of those tonight, so thanks again for your flexibility with the environmental soundscape. Leading us in conversation is the fearless Josh Kuhn, whose extraordinary work with the LA Public Library's menu collection is compiled in the book To Live and Dine in LA, Menus and the Making of the Modern City, published by Angel City Press. In addition to his work with the library collections, including his last collaboration around sheet music titled Songs in the Key of Los Angeles, Josh is also an author and professor in the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. So I hope you enjoy the conversation, and please help me give a warm welcome to our guests.
Thank you, Maureen. Can you guys hear me okay? Feeding back a little bit? All right, we're going to improvise sonically best we can. First, let me just thank Aloud for having us here, Library Foundation, LA Public Library, and all of you for coming out tonight. It's I think, you know, you guys actually look better outside, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So it looks good. Very good-looking crowd. This is the second of our public programs that we've been doing around To Live and Dine in L.A. Part of what we've been trying to do with this project is use the menus to explore kind of multi-platform analysis of the relationship between food, restaurant history, food history, and food culture in Los Angeles. Having great conversations like this, the event that Maureen mentioned on August 9th. I just want to give you a tad more info so that you go home immediately and buy tickets. This is an event that I'm doing with Chef Roy Choi and Rocket Era Science of Dilated Peoples, legendary LA hip-hop crew. And we are doing a live DJ-driven mixtape. DJ Zoe from the Line Hotel will be rocking the ones and twos, and at the same time, Roy Choi will be rocking the ones and twos induction burner stoves on stage. And we will have all kinds of different musicians, speakers. Susana Guzman, the mezzo-soprano for the LA Opera, is going to sing the menu to her favorite restaurant, El Tepayac. Worth the ticket alone.
Hey.
Front row, keep it down.
Yeah.
The evening will end with an epic freestyle hip-hop battle between the legendary freestyle rhymer MC Supernatural taking on Roy Choi in an ingredients versus hip-hop battle. So lots more incredible actors, activists, chefs are going to be in the mix. To kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about tonight, I thought I would read a little bit from the book just to get us going. This is a part of the book that has nothing to do with menus, per se, and everything to do with the history that I think informs the backstory to what we're talking about tonight. Before Los Angeles became a city of restaurants, it was a city of food. The city of angels began as a pueblo of dandelion and prickly pear, of acorns and amaranth, pigweed and pine nuts. The city only exists because of its food. The Spanish troops needed something to eat. And as it grew, it became a city of oranges, city of limes, of grapes, of oysters, of cattle, of potatoes, of pan dulce and tamales. In the 18th century, local missions flourished on homegrown crops of quince, pigweed, and berries and imported all of the oranges, grapes, and figs that would quickly be seen as native, like that other iconic imposter, the palm tree. It has good land for planting all kinds of grains and seeds, wrote the Franciscan Father Juan Crespi of the Los Angeles Basin. And it is the most suitable site, he said, of all that we have seen for a mission, for it has all the requisites for a large settlement. It was also good land for planting grapes. Starting in 1832 with Jean-Louis Vignier's El Aliso Vineyard, a quarter mile of grapes along the LA River, Los Angeles was a vintner's paradise and quickly emerged as the nation's top profit-turning wine center. By 1850, there were 100 vineyards in LA County, more than anywhere else in the nation. And if you look at the official seal of the city of Los Angeles, you will indeed see grapes. You will also see oranges, and you will see olives. In the 19th century, Chinese farmers worked the fields that are now the LA Live Entertainment Megaplex. Wouldn't it be amazing to go back to that? Ran a booming abalone trade and grew daikon and gobo with Japanese farmers up and down the LA River. By 1903, the city market was up and running in Chinatown. Cows and sheep roamed free on the old ranchos. Wheat grew in the San Fernando Valley. Corn sprouted in El Monte, and seafood was bountiful at the beaches. You moved here for the climate and you stayed for the agriculture. Eating well was part of the pre-urban draw, a theme that left a strong mark on early LA publishing. There were menus here before there were books. The first two hardcover books ever published in Los Angeles, one of them was a cookbook, Los Angeles Cookery, from 1881. The fundraising collection from the Ladies' Aid Society of Fort Street Methodist Episcopal Church gathered local family friends from Madame Chevalier's cabbage soup and Mrs. Hazeltine's fish balls to Mrs. M.G. Moore's katydid pudding that were all scrupulously temperate. In her 1925 memoir, Adobe Days, Sarah Bixby Smith offered glimpses of food production on the ranchos and its distribution to markets and restaurants throughout the city. When her family sat down for a meal at Rancho Los Alamitos, the meat was sourced from outside the kitchen window. Sugar and flour came in barrels from Los Angeles. Veggies came from a Chinese peddler, and all the cooks were Chinese. Salads, she wrote, were unknown. Imagine. But we sometimes had lettuce leaves dressed with vinegar and sugar. Creamed toast was a main dish, and donuts were a staple. By the time her family moved to L.A. in the 1870s, there were fruits and jellies and cakes all for sale at Hazard's Pavilion. In the old plaza, there was the first L.A. ice cream man, who she called the white-clad Mexican, selling treats from a freezer on his head. The abundance of vegetables, of fruit and fish and cattle helped keep the city's cost of living down. An 1895 article in the L.A. Times proclaimed Los Angeles in 1895 the most affordable big city in the country, because everything from its mutton, tomatoes, and potatoes to its flour and butter was cheaper here than everywhere else. By the turn of the century, food became an official real estate lure. Citrus, avocados, and walnuts all played a starring role in the civic booster campaigns that helped sell the place to the sickly and to all of those sun-deprived Midwesterners dreaming of a new life among the orange groves. At the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, Los Angeles represented itself as an elephant covered in 850 pounds of walnuts, wearing a belt of lemons and touting a basket full of corn, wheat, and barley. So when I started to look through the historic menu collection and we saw all of these incredible restaurants from the 1870s up through the present moment, we were faced with a big question, which is we're looking essentially at an archive of places where people had enough money to go out, sit down, and eat food at a restaurant. Menus are, in that sense, there's many senses to them, but in that sense, they are documents of a particular history of privilege. And so how to talk about menus in the setting of a public library? How to talk about menus in the context of contemporary Los Angeles, which, as we will talk about in detail, is undergoing a serious food crisis? I brought Chef Roy Choi with me into the collection to start thinking about these issues. Roy had just given a talk at the Mad 3 conference. Ron was just at the Mad 4 conference, and was talking about this dilemma of being a restaurateur in the age of food insecurity. And so that challenge for me became crucial, that this could not be a book and this could not be an exhibit, could not be a project celebrating restaurants. Instead, we had to approach menus through a different frame, menus as urban texts, to get at what one scholar called the sociology of the meal. How can we think about larger social issues? It meant recognizing the fact that along with fair housing, along with the fight for a living wage, along with the fight for educational access, jobs, healthcare, parks and recreational facilities, a livable city is a city with equal access to food. When people talk about having the right to the city, as Marxist geographers have for decades, part of what it means for everybody to have a right to the city, as we'll talk about, is a right to food. And luckily, Los Angeles is a city that might be rich in problems, rich in inequities. It is also a city that has, from its very inception, been a city rich in activism, rich in reimaginings from the bottom up, from the margins, from the outside in. And I'm thrilled. Tonight we have three people who have dedicated their lives and their work to rethinking this city through food, understanding food's kind of foundational role in rethinking sustainability, not sustainability in the strictly agricultural sense, but sustainability in the human sense, sustainability in the planetary sense. And so to get us going, I want to share some statistics that I know you all know. And then I want to have you respond to these statistics about what you're all doing to deal with them. And forgive me those in the audience who might know these already. In Los, there are 25,000 places to eat, and yet we are the epicenter of hunger. We have a youth insecurity rate of any county in the country. Nearly 2 in 10 families in Los Angeles are food insecure. 61% of all adults in Los Angeles are overweight or obese, and that number goes up for African American and Latino adults. 47% of children in Los Angeles County eat fast food at least once a week. Over 80% of LAUSDs come from food insecure homes. and in a neighborhood that is important to everybody up here that we're going to talk about tonight, Tangelis, 72% of restaurants are fast food. So these are real numbers that have very real consequences for people's livelihoods on the ground. And I would just love it to start us off tonight if each of you could just share a little bit about kind of how you start to do work in the face of that, where the imagination comes from, and then what are the action steps that you've all taken along your path. So Neelam, if you'd start us off.
Yeah, I mean, I moved to Los Angeles, to South LA, South Central, about just under 20 years ago. And I had no plans to do what I'm currently doing. I literally moved with two young children and faced the issue that many people living in South Central Los Angeles and in many other communities like it face, which is that I couldn't access the food that I wanted to get for my family. So, you know, from there, it was just a question of connecting with other people in the neighborhood, in the community, and allies across Los Angeles to think about what we could do to change that picture of food in our neighborhood. And so what we've been doing since then is essentially building a food system from the ground up in South LA that's based on growing food locally at small urban farms that we have created, some of which we still maintain, connecting with small farming families regionally and purchasing directly from them, and then doing everything we could to cut out any middle cost and to bring really high quality food and make it available affordably to folks in our neighborhood. And in the process of doing that, building in educational programs, training for our young people, and creating jobs, and essentially building commerce and trade, keeping dollars in our neighborhood, doing with food what has been done with food for millennia, which is using it as an engagement point to build community, to build critical thinking, and to build an environment in which we all want to live.
Thank you, Neelam. Ron.
How do you tackle this? Was that the
Yeah, what are the steps just in your own path that you've taken?
You keep waking up, you know?
My goal is to have you hanging on every word so that we bring the volume down just so you miss a few things and then you come back and you can't wait to hear it.
I'm a fashion designer, dude. I'm not a gardener or, you know, some activist or an anarchist or, you know, so, well, maybe I'm, my brain. I got thrown into this, you know, and I found out that it was by design. You know, that's what this is like. It's not a perfect storm that this is. If I go to Philadelphia, the same thing had happened. If I go to Detroit, the same thing had happened. If I go to Houston, the same thing has happened. Chicago. It's like if it's black or brown in that community, mm-hmm. you're not going to have any healthy food. And my whole thing is if it's not there, you put it there. So that's kind of how I got started. I remember I went to a store and I picked up a tomato and it said, maybe coated with shellac to preserve freshness, and I'm like, ain't that the stuff we had in junior high that we put in wood shop? You know, you put it under wood. What the hell do I need shellac on my tomatoes for? You know, so it was getting there, but that really I think was the straw was that and to realize that. The one thing that is supposed to be making us healthy is literally killing us. You know, we can find dialysis centers. You can't find a dialysis center in Beverly Hills, you know, but they got the blinking light, you know. So, and what do we get in our neighborhoods? They close down a so-called supermarket and put in a drugstore that has a sign that says CVS Drugs and Liquor. I mean, it's a drugstore. You know, but they also serve drugs and liquor. And two blocks down, there's the dialysis center. That was kind of what, it's like, okay, enough of this. Let's change this design. You know, let's design, have people wake up and design the lives that we want to live. And that's how I got into it. I mean, I just started planting food on the street and in my yard. And I, and the reason why I was on the street is because I want people to see, like, yo, we can change this. Stop waiting for somebody to do it for you. Do what you're supposed to. It's your life. It's your family's life. You know, but I think a lot is going to be, it's hard, because what we are doing is changing culture. And how the hell do you change culture? You know, so that's why. And I approach it as art. It's all art, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's where I start.
Okay. Cool. Thank you. Elizabeth.
For me, can people hear me? I cannot hear myself very well. For me, I guess I can think of many connections. One is me being a student in LAUSD in 1994. When I arrived to LA, it was my first time actually experiencing school food. And I depended on school food, like many students today. And that, I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing, like, that we have, that there are programs. The issue is that how do we make those programs help meet the nutritional needs of the students and make it a learning opportunity also? So that's kind of like my beginning, I guess, without knowing it. Then I became a parent, and then I had to take my child to kinder, and I was really scared. I was really scared, and because it was a different thing, even though I was familiar with the food, the school food environment. But I guess as a parent, for people who have kids, and for me, I just wanted to, like, protect my child and just... So I actually got recruited. I've been organizing on other issues, and I was recruited by one of the organizers that was working on the soda ban campaign and the junk food, you know, banning junk food from LAUSD, not only in the vending machines, but in the cafeteria. And so for me, I think this is a lens in which we can not only benefit, not only I can change, let's say, as a parent or as a person who lives in LA and a family, but also target at such a huge institution as LAUSD, the second largest school district in the country, and say, you know, we can do better. I mean, you just described it to us, the origins of LA. I love that. I'm going to read that. It doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to be, you know, processed food. It doesn't have to be that kids are rushing to eat quickly and, you know, be done because the bell is ringing, or skip the whole meal because there's not enough time to eat. You know, food justice and has many components. It's, like I was sharing before, it's not only about nutrition. It's about the access to it. It's about feeling comfortable sitting around the table and be cool with, you know, like, everyone gets to eat. Everyone gets to eat good food. And I don't have to be... to pay so much money or be low income or have some stigma divisions happening. I mean, food is an activity that we all do every day as living, as human beings and as living things on this planet. So it shouldn't be that crazy. It shouldn't be that difficult. So right. I think that's kind of like where I got in.
It's interesting. I mean, all of you in different ways, your work has led you to interact with institutions of various sorts. Collective eye roll. to work with institutions of various sorts and various sizes, which of course should seem ridiculous if we're talking about food, right? Which should be at its core a kind of non-institutional or de-institutional subject. But I'm wondering if each of you could talk a little bit as, you know, in the context of your work, how you negotiate strategically with the various institutions that you deal with. Because it's a really important part of getting the messages out, of getting the work done, maybe, or maybe not. Maybe it's about ignoring the institutions, but I have a feeling I know who's going to say that. So maybe we could hear a little bit about the institutions as a strategy, because I think it's an important part of the conversation.
Yeah.
You want to start, Mila?
Sure. Well, you know, somebody mentioned my connection to the Healthy School Food Coalition, which is actually how Elizabeth and I met many years ago. you know, through that experience, I was working as a volunteer with CSU at the time, and we sat down and we saw we'd also been involved in a number of other policy change kind of initiatives, and what we felt collectively was that, you know, you can change policy, but it doesn't necessarily change what's happening on the ground. And we saw that with the soda ban in South LA, right? We actually saw on the ground, it didn't really change the situation. The healthy cafeteria reform motion didn't actually change the situation on the ground in schools in South LA for our kids. So we kind of stepped back as a team of people, because believe it or not, I'm amazing, but it's not just me. There's a whole team of folks that I've worked with, have worked with. There's a lot of people that make this happen. And we decided that, you know, what we wanted to do was actually try and step away from institutions, from that kind of engagement. And I'm not here dissing anybody, because I think a movement involves many different forms of activism, right? But our goal was to step back and to really decide that we were going to build a model of what is possible in the community that we were in. And I want to say this, you know, your first question, we're not doing brain surgery. This is not space travel, right, or time travel. This is stuff that people have been doing for eons, growing your own food. There's nothing, we're not creating something new. You know, this is something that our ancestors and native peoples all over the world have done forever, since human beings have existed. It's the thing that is the precursor to sort of civilization, right? Is the ability to actually nurture ourselves with agriculture. So it's really just going back to that. And so we've chosen in the work we do to say, okay, we understand we're going to have to deal with these entities where we have to, but we're just going to try our best, really, to ignore them as much as possible and to do what we can. And so that's really what our work has been built on. Now, sometimes, you know, they come and they come face to face with us. So some of you may know we're dealing with a situation right now with one of our mini farms. The Expo Urban Mini Farm in South LA is one of the spaces, a 3/4-acre space that is absolutely beautiful in a concrete jungle. Those of you who haven't been there, please come visit. It has numerous programs that happen out of that space, from all the way from pre-kinders through our entire community up to seniors come into that space and do all kinds of stuff there, right? The food we grow there goes into our village marketplace, gets distributed in our neighborhood. And we were told just under 4 weeks ago in a meeting that that space was going to be taken and turned into a parking lot, right? You know, and we were told in this meeting by a city employee that the pressure for that to happen was coming from the state and from USC. So, you know, and there's a whole, you know, maybe I'll get into later in another response, because I don't want to take up everybody else's time, a little bit more into what's happening with that. So sometimes we have to deal with these entities, but honestly, what we have to do, and I can't emphasize this enough, we have to create our own solutions, right? We have to stop waiting for the Trader Joe's and the whoever, right? Again, not dissing anybody. But we have to create our own solutions, and we have to build what we want to see within our own neighborhoods.
Ron, would you say that strategy of kind of ignoring the institution and just doing your thing, is that a strategy that has worked for you?
Yeah.
handed you that, by the way. Yeah.
I mean, you got to get gangster with it, you know, because they created this. They know it doesn't work. They know the design doesn't work. They know the schools don't work. You know, in certain areas, you ain't teaching these kids nothing. Okay, so now you're serving them this food that has no nutritional value whatsoever. What is going to happen to this kid? He's not learning nothing. Plus, he doesn't have food to nourish his body and to have all the facilities working the right way. It's by design. So why am I going to deal with the people who designed this shit? It makes no sense to me. So you've been put, it doesn't benefit us. It benefits somebody else. It benefits the prison industrial complex. It definitely benefits the medical industrial complex and sometimes the military industrial complex. But it's not benefiting, it's killing us. okay? These communities, as far as I'm concerned, are kill zones, you know, and they're being terrorized and they're being occupied by these. Why am I going to deal with somebody who set this up? Why do I have to deal with the, no, when we can do it faster. We're there. We know what's happening. You know, we need to devise our own systems like we did and make it work that way, because they're by design. I can't reinforce that into people's head. People don't see it, and a lot of times they don't want to see it. Even the people in the communities don't even know that their life has been designed for them. These kids don't know that they're raised with barcodes on their necks, okay, that readable by prison scanners. Why is South Central, like, dying from the simplest, most curable diseases that they are? Why are they letting these, it's criminal that they're letting these companies into our neighborhoods. Somebody's benefiting, you know, and when we have to, it's up to us to change that. It's up to us to stop tearing up our neighborhoods. It's up to us to stop terrorizing our neighborhoods. You know, it's up to us to make our neighborhoods healthy and show others how that happens and to change this food culture. I mean, you have to deal with them to a point, but to me, I wish I didn't have to. I mean, I wish we could put them in. I'll leave that thought.
Could you walk us through? Like, could you give us an example of an action step that you've done, something you've done that has kind of either maybe gotten pushback from the city, gotten pushback from. Institution and kind of how you've negotiated.
Well, I mean, it's a couple. I mean, the fact that I'm here now, what I'm doing is not special. I'm not some special guy. The people want me to go talk and to come and show them. It's like, go on the internet, dude. You know what I'm saying? It's a tomato. It's not new. Okay? So what I'm doing is not special. And I'm telling people, you're me. I'm not just some, oh, my God, it's him. No, it's not him. It's you. You know, so, and that's what I'm trying to get into people's head. What I did with the Parkway situation, I mean, I was literally, I had done it 7 years prior to when I did it, and I had to take it out. I literally went to court and was going to be arrested. This time, 7 years later, I'm like, hey, nobody's looking. Let me do it again, because I'm not mowing this dirt anymore.
For those who don't know about that, could you talk just briefly about what the Parkway work was?
The Parkways are the strip of land in front of your house. Anybody knows with the grass on it. So now, thanks to me and a couple of other people, you know, you can now plant food on your Parkway. You can see the nails in my hands. some people get that. You know, it was illegal to grow food, and a lot of times in these neighborhoods, there's no other space to grow food. That's all you might have is the Parkway. And it wasn't even that. It started for me as beautification. You know, I'd come out and there's dressers and toilets and condoms, and nothing happened. I didn't get no kind of trouble or nothing, you know, but I planted a broke loose, you know. So that's a culture that we have to change, and that's what I did with that. I have a 150-foot sound keep going off on and off. I don't know why. 150-foot Parkway by like 9 feet, and trees and all kinds of veggies but what I wound up creating, unbeknownst to me, was an ecosystem, because all of a sudden I have birds that I've literally never seen in South Central in my life, and dragonflies and hummingbirds, and I mean, so I'm kissed by hummingbirds every day, you know. So that's what you create. You're creating life, mm-hmm. You know, and so you realize that this space was dead, you know. So you realize that these neighborhoods are dead. They're designed to kill us. You know, and with that, I got in a lot of trouble. I got in a lot of trouble, and when they found out I had done it before, they just, you know, I was a speed bump after that. And until, you know, all of a sudden, I'm in LA Times, I'm on NPR, and then when I did TED, it was It was a wrap because they ignored me for like 8 months until I got, when I'm on TED, I got a phone call. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hey, dude, hey, please don't talk bad about L.A. We love what you're doing. I'm like, who is this? You know, yeah, we heard your success. What's success? I'm not getting paid for nothing. What was success? And so that was the turnaround, was the TED. And it just, after that, you know, the councilman thanked me for introducing this problem to him. They didn't see it as a problem, which is, I think, what happens a lot in the community. People don't see it as a problem because this is not the culture.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a kind of parallel tactic in some ways that in the exhibit upstairs, Fallen Fruit, a pair of artists, go and create maps around Los Angeles of places where fruit trees that are on private property hang over onto public land. And so they give people maps so you can drive around the city and collect fruit that is just falling and is rotting and going to waste and not being used. And there's a similar idea of kind of rethinking the city.
Well, and that's another situation I wanted to do with a library, the Vermont Square Library. It has an acre of land behind it that they're doing absolutely nothing with. People don't even walk. I wanted to turn this into this urban oasis, like Alan Purple's garden in New York, or like now they have the train. The High Line, like the design. Like, I wanted this to be our High Line, where we have a cafe there on the premises, where we have a garden, where we have an orchard on this premises, and all the food that's around that neighborhood, now people can come and trade or sell their food right there, and now we have premium South Central, you know, jellies and South Central compost.
Let's do that.
You killed Just keep it okay, you know. So I wanted to, that's where the business aspect come in. That's where the opportunity, not no damn hope, okay? Opportunity, because you can't do nothing but hope. But hope something happens, you know. So this is what I wanted this neighborhood to be. So all that food that Fallen Fruit is mapping, it could go in. It could we can turn that into revenue. We can turn that into opportunity. We can turn it into a gleaning program for kids, for people. And that's what I wanted this to be, but it was, you know, it was shot down, you know, 9 months later. Like, hey, you think we can start with two garden boxes? I'm like, really, you know, is that what this community deserves? So that's what we get. But what they want to do now is, you know, is change the name again. They want to call it Sola.
Yes.
Dumb. Like, why don't you change the neighborhood before you change the damn name, you clown? You know. You know.
Yes, that's a whole other topic, the changing of names in L.A. Elizabeth, with you're dealing on a regular basis with a very large institution that you desperately want to change from the inside. Mm-hmm. Could you just talk a little bit about the challenges and the possibilities of working with LAUSD?
Yeah, I will just say I really agree, you know, at a personal level, even as an organizer, with what we just heard from Nilam and Ron. And that's kind of like my first instinct, like, whatever, we're going to do our own thing. And also I see the value and getting in there with the institutions. And, I mean, we have to develop a lot of patience and a lot of resistance and a lot of insistence and a lot of... just muscle, you know, dealing with this, because I don't know that the school system or the nutritional programs are going to go away. And actually, I don't want them to go away. That's why we're doing this, to transform the programs, because we're talking about nutrition, we're talking about time, we're talking about an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to socialize, and also we're talking about millions of dollars, you know, federal funding that comes into the state, that comes into, in this case, LA, money at the state level that should be coming. And also pushing, not only pushing LAUSD as an entity, but doing work to actually put to push the USDA. I mean, if we look at the the budget for food, we know no one cares about food. We know no one cares about healthcare. I mean, it looks in the numbers. It's a very, we don't need a translation, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we push, you know, how do we transform that? And it takes a long time. And it could be really boring and really frustrating. But I think just for today, we there is something to be pushing there. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've seen, it's kind of like a miracle, I've seen a lot of changes, even though, I mean, I'm more like focusing on like, wow, did this talking about menus, many menus have changed, but it's a constant fight around like, you know, I know in 2011, pizza disappeared from the menu, all this work, right? Peanut butter sandwiches disappeared, chicken nuggets disappeared from, you know, nachos disappeared from the, and many times we don't know that. I think also, I mean, I don't know if this is what I'm saying is making sense, but it is a long haul. And so my first instinct is to say the hell with it. But it's also an opportunity to push and organize board members. It's an opportunity to work. I mean, for a long time we've been talking about organic food or organic food that is locally grown, like distributed locally. You know, it's also an opportunity to say, you know, there's all this money for food. How can we best use it? Use that money, invest that money in the local economy. So it's a long struggle, and for sure always trying to get to create some champions and push for championship among the board, which I think I could say, I mean, the reality is that we have like one leader at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that person goes away, they no longer are part of the board, and so we need to develop, right? Because it is sad. I mean, it is sad. In LA, in any other city, I can dare to say, food is not the priority. Eating is not the priority. Around money, around time, mm-hmm. around quality. I mean, I work with a lot of families, and you know, in the organizing work, and most of the population in LA usually is very low income. We want those people, I mean, in the ideal world, you know, those students to have access to good food, good education, and good food, enough time for, you know, socializing, recreation, learning, eating, mm-hmm. right? The programs are there. They are just, they haven't been working for so many years. So I guess the work that we're doing is to try to push, as an experiment, really, you know, to push and make them work mm-hmm. to the best of, you know, and that also has to do with like building a movement, building education around it, so that it's not like the three of us are pushing, but like other people are pushing, and wherever you go, you hear the same message. Mm-hmm. We deserve good food. Good food is a human right. You know, we deserve access to water. We deserve, you know, access to, you know, sitting down and eating
right.
in a calm, relaxed way.
And what you said before, though, is important. This idea, this, the idea that people don't care about food, right? I mean, which is true and not true, because certainly people care about food,
yes.
right? Certain folks and certain food. Evan Kleiman of Good Food has called this the schizophrenia of food culture in Los Angeles, right? Robert Gottlieb, who you work with at you know, you've worked with at Occidental, talks about this kind of where our title for tonight, in a way, came from, inspired by his notion of the dichotomy of being a foodie city and a food bank city. Mm-hmm. So people care about food, but not necessarily about feeding
yeah.
others, perhaps, would be one way to say it.
And I guess I just really quickly, I didn't mean to say we don't care or they don't care. But I mean, talking about institutions,
yeah.
with the numbers and the budgets, it shows us very clearly, I mean, we're all smart people. Maybe, you know, maybe the USDA is not showing that they really want to feed the kids properly. You know, the USDA not only finances school food, I mean, they finance the whole menu. Talking about menu, they create the whole menu mm-hmm. for the whole entire country, right? Well, so, you know what I'm saying? So how can we shift that?
You guys want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we, if we're talking about the USDA and we're talking about systemic issues, let's talk about the food lobby and the millions of dollars we pay farmers in this country to produce food that is just sitting in, you know, in ships on the oceans that is not being consumed because, you know, it, and we're just literally, because of the system that's been set up, because of the fact that politicians are being, you know, lobbied with people with who have a lot of money, we're keeping this system that doesn't work going, right? So it comes down to we're in a system, a food system that is broken. The food system we currently have in the world, in the U.S. in particular, is absolutely broken. And I think that that has to be our starting point. It has to be understanding that. And any other talk about there being any schizophrenia about people not caring about food is nonsense, in my opinion. Everybody cares about food. Who doesn't want to come to have a good meal every day? Like, there's nobody who doesn't want to eat a delicious meal every time it's mealtime. There's nobody who doesn't understand the difference between good food and not good food, right? This is something we've been sold. There is this idea, and I still hear it all the time, that communities like South Central, the reason they have the garbage they have is because that's what they want, right? And it's absolutely, like, untrue, and it's victim blaming. You know, these communities are the way they are for all sorts of reasons. Long-term systemic issues have made our communities the way they are, not because we don't want good food. And essentially what we've done is proven in building the business we built. Now, I referred earlier, I'm gonna just come back to this point, to this, you know, 3/4 acre piece of land that is gorgeous, you know, all the stuff that Ron talked about, the butterflies and the hummingbirds, the native bees, which you don't get, I haven't seen anywhere else, right? All of that that we have, the enormous varieties of fruit trees and seasonal fruits and all the native foods that we are reintroducing in our business, right, that you can't even buy in other stores. So you have this ridiculous situation of this little three-acre piece of land that they're trying to take back, cost them no money for us to be there other than their lost income from parking. And yet you have this situation where, what, 2 weeks ago, the city of LA, our city, our elected officials, who pimp, honestly, off this stuff about South LA and food deserts all the time when they want to, right? These same people disgustingly voted through at the city council to give the Nogales Corporation, a private investment firm, right, that normally their investments start at $10 to $20 million, they voted to give 2 acres of city-owned land to the Nogales Corporation to open a crappy numero uno, because that's what our community needs, yet another, you know, BS, low-standard, sub-quality place to go buy rubbish that nobody else will buy and nobody they don't sell in any other community. And on top of giving them this land, they gave them $750,000 worth of public money. Right? This is the city council just voted to do this 2 weeks ago. So, I mean, I have to look at this and say, this system is broken. Yes, we've got to do what we can. And yes, you know, I respect anyone doing work in this. And you know, Elizabeth, I respect your work a great deal. Because at the end of the day, there are 750,000 of our kids in this school system being fed this crap, right? So we've got to do something. There's got to be a stand taken somewhere. But ultimately, it comes down to how you believe you make change, right? And the reason we're in this moment now with the food justice movement and food being this currently, like, issue that it is that everyone wants to talk about, right? The reason we're in this now is because a lot of people all over this country, small grassroots efforts, have been doing work consistently and patiently for many years to shine the light on this issue, to create model projects. And I believe how you transform a system that is broken is by beginning to build models for what an alternative is at the same time that other people are attacking that system from within. So that's what we're trying to do. And at the same time, we understand we have to engage with the system in some way, because unfortunately, as much as I'd like to put them all on a spaceship and send them somewhere else, maybe that's what Ron was going to say, maybe something rude, I don't know. The fact is they're here, right? And you know, and we've got to try and engage in the way we can, but we really have to build our own models. We have to come together and decide what we want to see, and that's what we've got to do. That's got to be our primary thing, building the models that we want to see, being the answer that we want to see, and creating those models for ourselves, and then engaging with power where we have to, but with that basic understanding that was laid out for us many, many years ago. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has, and it never will.
Ron, you want to pick
up? We have a system where has even with the broken thing that they call the nonprofits, I think it's a broken system, and it's the same way with this store situation that Neelam's talking about, whereas you have people with a lot of money that they get the money. Like somebody like us that's on the ground, that's really doing work, they're not helping to advance our work. You know, they'll throw us maybe some kibbles and bits, but we're not getting that kind of money, and we're being played like we're being played like this. What fruit has the most potassium? Who knows that? Bananas, right? Hell no. They're number 50.
That's right.
Okay? That's some more lobbying stuff that they lobbied us to think that bananas are the number one. But everybody knows. Hey, I need a banana. It's number 50. Okay? So we're being played like that constantly. It's hard. It's hard to do this kind of work.
What's
number one?
Blueberries?
I don't remember. I'm not an academic, dude. You know, but it's hard. I mean, this is not for the faint of heart. You don't choose this kind of work, because we trying to make this sexy. Right now, it's not. Why y'all keep having trouble with my mic? We're I think that's the only way we're gonna do this is to make it sexy and to have people realize, have these kids realize that they can have a livelihood from doing this. But it's not only that. People ask me, how much food can you grow in a space this size? And I'm telling you, I really don't care. I don't at all, because it's not about the food. It's about people. People are our biggest resource, okay? And we're not using them the way. I don't tell people. I grow people, okay? I don't grow food. And then maybe they'll grow some food, maybe. But first, it's getting to people and growing them. It's like planting that seed. That seed is a metaphor for everything in life to me. You know, when you put the right seed and you have a gardener watching over it, it's just like a parent watching over their kids and making sure that that the right things go into these kids. It's the same thing with your garden. So that's. It's hard. It's hard work, man. I wouldn't have, if somebody would have known. I mean, you got these shark nonprofits that get you in and try to take your money from you. That nobody warns you about. That's what happened to me and my fiscal sponsor. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, when we started looking at restaurant menus, we've got the on our screen. So you can't see it, but imagine. Earliest menu in the library's collection is 1875, all right? And if you go back and look at menus from the 1870s, 1880s, early 1900s, what you see increasingly are dishes that are labeled by farm, right? So this is not farm to table as we know it now. This was the original, because where else could the food come from in 1900? It had to come from a farm. And so you would have chicken on a menu that was from a Pomona farm, right? If you were eating at the Hotel St. Catherine on Catalina Island, the figs were from Catalina, the sand dabs were from right off the coast. What made good restaurants in LA in the early 1900s at every level was that people said it came from our own ranches, our own restaurant. Every restaurant had a little farm, right? You had places like Clifton's, right? You had cafeterias in the 1920s and 30s who dedicated themselves to feeding the city. No one at Clifton's was turned away because you couldn't afford a meal, right? Everybody could sit down at that table. In 1940, nearly one half of the LA food supply came from farms within 50 miles of the city, right? Now only 1% of food is grown that stays. here in Los Angeles. So we've got this, like, this moment, right? We've got this turn of the 20th century moment. Obviously, we have the middle of the century where the industrialization of food, grocery store culture, et cetera, take over. So how do we get back, in a sense, to that? How do we restore the historical balance? What do you guys think about that kind of historical disjuncture between that early period and now?
I think we have the food right where we... I don't want my food loco. I want my food hyper-loco. Okay, I want to reach behind my back, you know, and not even look and know that I have food in my hand. That's possible. And looking at this menu, I didn't know that there was a difference between dinner and supper, you know?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So, just in terms of, like, you know, what about this disjuncture and how do we go back?
Hold on, I don't know if people can hear you. Maybe grab Ron's mic, see if that works.
So, I do think it is about going back to that, and I, like I said, I don't think it's that we're creating anything new. Mm-hmm. It's about going back to that within a modern context. So we're not Luddites. It's not about trying to, you know, like, erase the world we live in. But it is about, you know, seeing what's possible. And there are so many examples. We only have to look at the tiny little country compared to the U.S. of Cuba and see what they have done with their, you know, with their growing in cities. I mean, you know, with way less money, Cuba has as an entire country than I think Cuba's budget is something like the budget of one state in the U.S., right? It's not about money, right? It's really about kind of just deciding it's what we want to do. And so I think that to some extent it sounds kind of nerdy and silly maybe, but how do we do it? We just have to do it.
Yeah.
We just have to do it. We have to start coming together, growing locally, swapping food with each other, you know, putting pressure on everybody around us and every institution around us, whether it's our child's preschool, whatever it is, our childminder, that we want real food in those places. And we have to start coming together. And this is the other thing I've got to say, because even if we win this battle, and not even if we do, we are going to win this battle, and we are going to keep this urban farm that we have in South LA. Mm. But even if we do that, there's no guarantees, right? Like, if we win it this time, it's a prime piece of land in a community that everybody is after land. USC, the city, the state, right? Like, there's all kinds of expansion going on there. And those of us who've been there, folks been there longer than me, being pushed out and priced out. But if we're going to do it, we've got to decide to come together and do it. And some of that is that we've got to get really smart about this, right? We're constantly being pushed out of our neighborhoods and gentrified out. We've got to get smart about it. So one of the things that we decided to do was that we wanted to own our own property, knowing that in this society, the only thing that speaks is, unfortunately, private ownership. It's not that we care about that. So, you know, we came together to buy a 10,000 square foot lot so that we can, in fact, open little old us, you know, not all these huge foundations and all these millions that have been spent on this so-called problem in LA, but little old us are gonna open the first Beyond Organic market in South LA, right? And that is what people can do when they decide to come together and do stuff. That is what we need to do. Just do it.
Thank you. I've got a list of like 20 things that I still wanna ask you about. We don't have time for me to do that, but I'm planting seeds about market makeovers, debating the very notion of a food desert, food apartheid, the terms that we're using. I'm planning these for audience Q&As. When you sit down to write, I'll just want to end with this with some small point to kind of summarize, I think, in some ways. But when you sit down to write a book about food, I did a lot of research before with my students to figure out how to write this book, because there's never been a book written on the history of food in Los Angeles, which was kind of shocking.
Really?
It's true. The long history. And we had to start to figure out how to tell the story. So I read a lot of food books, and virtually every single book about food, every single book about restaurants uses this same quote in one way or another from Anthème Briat Savarin, a quote that is often cited. Tell me what you eat, and I shall tell you what you are, right? We've heard this a lot. But it strikes, and that's usually talked about, like, about, oh, the food that you, the communities eat and how it celebrates identity in your culture. But what is the flip side, the B side of that, is, you know, if you're eating blank, then you are blank. We can look at Los Angeles, and by actually looking at what communities eat what food, right, we can tell you who you are, right? Food is raced in this city, right? Food is priced, is classed in this city. Yep. Now, we're not alone in this, obviously, but in talking about Los Angeles, this direct correlation between, you know, show me what you're eating, and we can tell you what neighborhood you live in. We can tell you perhaps what schools you go to. And it's not a one-to-one direct correlation, right? But it starts those conversations. So I just want to personally, you know, for me, doing this project, being able to have the gift to work with the library and the incredible librarians to look at the menu history, the B-side to those stories are the stories you guys have shared tonight. And I'm just so honored and thankful for you guys for being here tonight. So I want to open it up. I know we got lots of ideas and comments and questions. I can see nobody. So I will unfortunately have to go front row because I see your hand, and then I see another hand there. And we have a microphone going around.
Hi, this question is for any of you. You've talked a lot about barriers faced with the lawmakers and the people that hold money. Do you ever encounter barriers empowering or encouraging people of the community to take care of these gardens or to make the changes with you?
Yes, that's a very big problem. And that's where the changing culture comes in. A lot of people like where I started an organization where that's what we did. We went to people's homes for free and we put in gardens, and you know, people would think that we were the help, and I'm like, no, I'll help you, but I'm not the help. You know, this is your garden. You know, you need to take care of it. And I think that's a thing with our society. It's so push button now that no one has skin in the game. They don't figure they need it. You get an app, you push a button, you know where Mars is. You know, you go to a drive-through window, you talk into a box, you drive 20 feet and they hand you a box of stuff that's supposed to be food, you know, and you good. So what we're trying to do is have people know, have skin in the game. You know, when that's where the whole thing, if a kid grows kale, they eat kale, you know, because now they're a part of this. They planted this seed. And it grew, and now I've seen it happen. So I don't need those statistics. I don't need all that, the stats and the statisticians. I see this little girl take this carrot out the ground, wipe it on her pants, and eat it. I'm good. So that's a major problem is to get people to understand that this is yours and you should take care of it. And that's why I treat it like it's art. This is your canvas. Mm-hmm. Is somebody going to tell you where to put the first brush stroke on your canvas? You know, you can be creative with this, and that's what we're trying. That's what we're trying to do. It's hard, you know.
There's a hand. Oh, go ahead, Elizabeth. Yes.
I mean, as far as school food, I would say that it's also it has been historically very difficult. You know. I really like the changing culture phrase because we're trying to change culture not only among board members or food services, which is its own entire, you know, department within LAUSD, within the school district, but also the parent centers, right? Most of the schools, not all of the schools, have parent centers. And so even to allow to you know, have a workshop or conversation around school food, you know, at the beginning it was very threatening, and it has changed. It has improved, there is more openness to talk about that. But also talking about the ownership. You know, these are your schools, these are your cafeterias, this is the restaurant in the school, and it's called cafeteria. And you know, the students have school food rights. I mean, most of the policies in the school district actually came directly from students and parents talking about the issues, you know, what are the issues in accessing food? What are the issues? What are the barriers that sort of like help us, or the issues that sort of make it difficult for a student, you know, in deciding, you know, should I go and eat breakfast? Should I go and eat lunch after school snack, or not? You know, and a lot of those is, you know, maybe the food doesn't look very good. or I don't have time to eat. I mean, constantly time to eat. That's why it's there's a whole policy on time to eat. You know, and it's a long struggle, like I said, but it is, there's much more openness. And the more we hear or talk about the changes, even if they are small, I mean, it gives more energy to continue.
And I want to point out that if you do a little Google searches on everybody, we've got some links on the program site for tonight. Elizabeth worked on this really great toolkit for school lunch reform that the PDF's online. Ron has incredible stuff online. Neelam has stuff online. If you go to the Library Foundation to Live and Dine project website, we have a whole section dedicated to food policy, food access, food equity, links to reports. More reports than you policy reports you'll ever want to read, and videos. We've got Ron's talk, lots of great stuff. So there's lots of places to go.
What about if we got the kids involved in the food that they eat? What about if they were in the cafeterias? What about they grew their food in the gardens? What about if they we showed them how to take ownership of this food? Literally, they're serving food to themselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many schools that have gardens, like you were saying. You help people to build their gardens at home, and then they think you are the help. And then that's, you know, how do we keep it sustainable? You know, it's either, you know, a student, you know, three students, a teacher right. and a student, and or a parent, teacher, and student. But someone needs to keep it going. I think for sure that's another key point in maintaining that. And I know Neelam has experience with gardens and things like that.
Well,
in schools.
I will say, yeah, in schools, but I think with youth in South LA and generally with community in South LA, your question is really at the core, because we have to remember that there's so much being thrust in terms of the other, right? Like, so we're dealing with a machinery, right? Which, you know, has all this stuff it's created to shove down our throats, even in terms of messaging like five a day, you know, that changes, you know, they change it all the time, but when it exists, it's kind of sacrosanct, right? And this is how in this work, you know, I began to say earlier, we're in this moment in this work where there's a kind of a moment that we've got to, right, where there's all this attention on this work. But we have to remember that any movement of people in any sphere has always become co-opted, right? So there's a way in which the work that we've created right now, it's become, the attention on it's become so big. The big corporate nonprofits have seen the money that's out there for it, right? So they're coming, you know, they're coming at it, and they're taking on work that was really grassroots, really meaningful, and they're flipping it and turning it into this sort of mindless, you know, cookie cutter messaging, you know, gardens on site. For example, we've had the direct experience of gardens we built at schools in South LA that we started building way back when nobody was talking about this issue, right? And building programs around those. And then someone like the American, you know, Heart Association comes in, gets $1 million or some ridiculous amount of money from the California Endowment, comes in, gets a contract with this private entity that just
put
took over this
blast.
School we worked at, right? You know, takes down our garden, our farm that we built over years, and puts in these ridiculous little boxes that you can grow nothing in, because that's the cookie cutter approach to right. this. And then, more importantly, to be honest with you, even more importantly than that, has content that has no relevance to the lives of our children. Our right. content is built around the cultural history of the foods of our community. Right. So if our community is Mexican Central American, we're talking about the milpa, the corn, bean, squash. We're talking about the way that the Aztecs and their predecessors like took the corn from a little grass as small as my pinky finger to develop it to what it is as we know now, right? We're talking about the foods that West Africans brought with them. You know, the yams and the black-eyed peas and the collard greens, and growing those foods together with these kids. All of that content is gone in favor of what's allowable under USDA guidelines, right? That's the problem. That's the problem when you start to get into, like, dealing with these entities, is that anything that has value gets sucked out, right? So that's the problem. But how you go about doing it, like, I'll tell you something, it's a big problem, but anytime we've engaged with a group of people and we've been able to do that on our terms, which is the only way we do it, we don't have any issues engaging them. Because as soon as you start to engage people around food based on who they are, their cultural food histories, where they're at in this moment, there is no problem. You can engage them and you can get them to start growing food and you can get them to start thinking about why our food environment is the way it is.
And what you just said about these big entities supporting other big entities is that's what's killing, you know, it's destroying it. It's destroying the game. I mean, that's why a lot of us can't get a hold and make really massive changes, because the money is going to other money. A lot of these foundations, they're funding places like the Heart Association and people that really don't need any money, you know, and that's she said it. That's what's happening.
There we go. There was a report that just came out that Anna LaPay and a bunch of other folks did about the really ingenious communication spin that's been going on around organic food, around gardening. There's like, I'll give you two quick examples and we'll get this second question. These two new organizations, the Alliance to Feed the Future and the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. So the Alliance to Feed the Future is actually funded by something which is amazing, the Frozen Pizza Institute. And the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance is funded by Elanco, Monsanto, and DuPont. This report is all about paying attention to the kind of communication spin that agribusiness is now following the lead, or learning from the work of on-the-ground activists, taking the language of on-the-ground reform and spinning it in a different way. Question number two. How's that for one answer to a question? Question number two.
At last. So my question is, we live in a world where not everyone can do everything. People do things very well. I get plumbers to help do plumbing. I get my mechanic to work on my car. So not everyone can grow their own food. And there are certain economies of scale that you can get by having a farm with 200 acres of trees as opposed to 1 acre of farms around the city. So how do you balance the benefits of small farms with the practicality and reality of not industrial farming, but certainly larger scale farms?
Yeah. No, it's a real question. It's an important question.
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. Like this is...
Now,
this,
keep
this
in mind, we have lots of hands.
Yes. Okay, so this is a red herring. This whole economies of scale thing. And actually, the more and more research that is coming out now is proving, there's a whole bunch of research that just came out of some universities in England, for example, which is, you know, showing, actually, they're saying that the way forward is to go back to smaller scale. It's actually about smaller scale and going back to that, both in growing food and in markets. You know, like, So, for example, the trend now in those places, which is not the U.S., unfortunately, but in those places which are innovative and far-thinking, is to actually go back to smaller scale, to go back to the small footprint markets where there's actually relationships with the neighborhood and the community, and to go back to small-scale growing. And the more and more evidence that is emerging about that is actually that small-scale growing, the food, not only can you grow... You can definitely grow enough food. Like, this is what they're doing in Cuba. They're growing small scale in the cities, and they just got to the point where they're growing about 40% of their produce in the cities in Cuba, right? This is so there's no way this cannot be done. Mm-hmm. And the other important thing about that is that what they're also showing is that those foods that are grown on a smaller scale have higher nutrition. They're also better for the environment. They're causing less damage. So on every level, it's all coming back to smaller scale. And it's okay if you don't have a green thumb. I believe everyone can grow food. That's what I personally, and I believe if you haven't been able to, you haven't engaged in it in a certain way. But even if you can't, if you can come and build a raised bed for us, you can come do the plumbing for our aquaponics system. There's a way you can be engaged in growing food, even if you're not growing food.
That's like saying everybody can have sex, right?
I don't know about that.
Because food, I don't know. Growing food is like, it's the same thing, you know.
So is Viagra fertilizer? Anyway.
How many? We got one in the back.
Hello, I'm a teacher. I garden since 1968 on my school campuses. But the real issue to me about feeding lots of children is that we have to bring back the kitchens to the cafeteria and not the warming ovens.
And then
when the whole school smells like some delicious thing,
exactly.
The kids are hungry, but you do have to give them enough time to eat, because if you're taking six shifts of kids through a cafeteria, they don't want to eat because they want to go outside.
We agree with that for sure.
Totally, yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Imagine if the kids were engaged in that, you know?
And also, no, I mean, you as a teacher and many people as parents or even as students or in any cafeteria, many schools, sadly, don't, I mean, we're talking about, you know, many schools have like a closet as the cafeteria. There's no kitchen, there's no equipment, there are two staff, right? So for sure, that is one of the goals. So we agree with that. And we need actually teachers and parents and food advocates and food growers and everyone to focus on this. We need a lot of support on that. Diversity and voices, for sure.
One more, perhaps? I can't see anything, I'm warning you.
Right over here. So this will be our final question. And first, we just wanted to update you that the book signing tonight will be held in the lobby right where the check-in table is. So we invite you to join us there next. And here's our final question.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that I actually know what you guys are doing in South Los Angeles. I worked with one of the stands, the fruit stands down there in South Los Angeles. And it's a wonderful work that's being done by in the community. But what I understand, like when you were saying the cookie cutter, the thing that came to me was Monsanto's and the genetic engineering that they do and how it's not even really good, nutritious food, fruits and stuff that they're giving you. Whereas when you grow your stuff yourself and you have the joy of planting a seed and watching it grow and nourishing it and nurturing it, and how the children, the young people, will see the seed grow and bloom to a fruit that they have had a part of in nurturing, and now to actually, when it's in full bloom, to share it with others and eat it and know that this is nutritious. This is a wonderful thing. This is a thing that not only young people in all the schools should really participate, but everyone, it's just wonderful thing, and it's something that, you know, we really do need to, if we start small in our own little communities and we grow our own little foods, you know, it will start the trend. One man teaches another, and I just want to just commend you guys on what you're doing, and I appreciate what you're doing. My question, well, that was just...
In the book, at one point I quote the pioneering food anthropologist Sidney Mintz, who said that when it comes to food, there's really only two core things that food is about. After, you know, the feeding you, keeping you alive bit, and the enjoying the pleasure of eating food. There's two things, and we've heard it tonight. Food is about communication, right? It's about storytelling. It's about spin. It's about how you talk about food. But it is always, he said, always about power. It is always about power. And this whole project for me has been eye-opening to understand the different ways that food's connections to communication and to power have functioned. All the work that you guys are doing, I think, speaks to that in a very direct way. So I want to thank Ken Brecker, the Library Foundation, for giving me a chance to do this, for having us here, the Aloud folks. All of you are incredible guests. The exhibit is upstairs. The book is out there. Join us August 9th at the Regent Theater for To Live and Dine in L.A., a live mixtape where Chris Cormier of the Los Angeles Mission will be on hand talking about feeding the homeless. And DJ Kavum and Alchemia Earth are going to do a culinary concert about hip-hop, vegan activism, and so much more. Thank you guys for coming out on this beautiful night.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.